You've always had what it takes to make it happen, and we know the right tools can make it easier. At Strayer University, we're always thinking about new ways to set you up for success. That's why we give you a brand new laptop when you enroll in a bachelor's program, so you can start off on the right foot and keep striving. Visit strayer.edu to learn more. Eligibility rules, restrictions, and exclusions apply. Connect with us for details. Strayer University is certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.
This is David Duncan, author of The Secret Lives of Customers, a detective story about solving the mystery of customer behavior. And you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a free copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome David Scott Duncan to talk about his book, The Secret Lives of Customers, a detective story about solving the mystery of customer behavior, published by Public Affairs. David Scott Duncan is a managing director at the strategy and innovation consultancy InnoSight, where he works with leaders to create customer-centric teams, strategies, and organizations. He is a leading authority on the theory and application of jobs to be done, with extensive experience conducting market investigations around the world. David is the co-author of two previous books, including the Wall Street Journal bestseller, Competing Against Luck, The Story of Innovation and Customer Choice, written with the late Harvard Business School professor Clayton Christensen. Prior to joining InnoSight, he worked as a consultant at McKinsey & Company, earned a PhD in physics from Harvard University.
Hello, Harvard, yo.
And an undergraduate degree in philosophy from Duke University. And, interesting fact, he is the heir to the Dunkin' Donuts fortune. David, congratulations on The Secret Lives of Customers, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Douglas. Great to be here. I really appreciate it.
Now, I'm confused, though, because your name is spelled different from Dunkin' Donuts. It's D-U-N-C-A-N. Was that like a decision you all made from a branding standpoint?
Yeah, it was a branding decision. And, you know, sometimes if I want to distance myself a little bit from the Dunkin' Donuts fortune, it's helpful to have a slightly differently spelled name.
Okay, great, great. So you went to Duke, and you are the third author, the third Blue Devil that I've interviewed. I've interviewed Drew Neiser and then Stephen Pressfield for the 400th episode. And this is really special to me, as some listeners may know, because my mother, Antoinette Burdett, is a graduate of Duke University. She graduated in 1944 and was the first woman to earn a varsity letter at Duke. And then one of my brothers went there. And so naturally, he was her favorite son. I'm kidding. She loved all of us. But I think if she met you, she would really like you, David.
Well, that's great to hear.
So you have a PhD in physics from Harvard. And I guess aside from an interest in physics, were you thinking about becoming a physics professor at some point?
Yeah, when I went to graduate school, I was pretty open-minded about what I might do when I was done, and just thought it was a great opportunity to get deep into a subject that I was really interested in. And as I was going through the graduate school, I guess I came to the realization that loving physics and loving being a physicist are two different things. And the career path probably wasn't for me. My interests have always been pretty broad, and they went in the direction of business. And I found myself increasingly reading about topics in the quote-unquote real world. Took a couple courses in the business school and decided I wanted to branch out into industry. Ended up getting a job at McKinsey, which I'd never heard of going into graduate school, but it seemed like a good way to, you know, broaden my resume and get some business exposure. And that was my transition into the business world.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I don't know of anyone who's studied philosophy or physics who's an academic slouch. So good on you. So I am so glad you contacted me a while back and sent me not just one copy of your book, but two. That's right, listener. One of you is going to be awarded a copy of this book. Now, we'll have to see, but if you share the interview on LinkedIn, or if I see that you're reaching out to the author to thank him for being a guest on the show, that'll help. Or if you're a Duke grad, I know there's some Duke grads who listen, but hey, enough about the Duke thing, but I am glad you sent me a copy of the book, and it is a truly exceptional book, and we're going to talk about why in a minute. But also, as we record this, this is a special day for me because
it's your birthday. We're going to party like it's your birthday.
That's right. It's my birthday. And I don't think I've ever recorded an episode on my birthday. So happy birthday to me. And just briefly about me, because I want this to be about my guest and the book he's written. I was born on Bruce Springsteen's 10th birthday. That's how I can always remember how old I am. But I was born on his 10th birthday, and he later wrote a song about me. And that one did so well, he actually... So he wrote two songs about my birthday, and I appreciate that. And he actually goes around telling everyone that he was born on the same birthday as me. But you know what's interesting, David, is I was born on the same day as the actor Jason Alexander, who was a cast member in the long-running American TV show Seinfeld. Yep. And he played a degenerate named George Costanza.
I mean, would it kill you not to be so funny all the time? That's all I'm asking. This woman thinks I'm very funny, and now you're going to be funny, so what am I going to be? I'm going to be a short, bald guy with glasses who suddenly doesn't seem so funny.
So... because this is my birthday, I have to let you know, I went to Starbucks because you get a free cup of coffee on your birthday at Starbucks if you have their app.
All these years, I didn't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm all about providing value to the listener and the guest. So if you have the Starbucks app, you know, a lot of you can probably just stop listening now. Because, no, I'm kidding. But you get a free cup of coffee. So since it was free, I went in and I said I'd like a large, I'm not kidding here, a large triple shot caramel macchiato. And I know I say that because it sounds like I can speak Starbucks, but I had no idea what I was ordering, but somebody told me to get that. So I am really, really fired up. So for this episode, David, I'm going to read the entire book really fast, and then we're going to have a four-hour discussion about it. I'm kidding. I'm not going to do that. But as we start talking about the book, you're going to understand the significance of why I went to get coffee today. So I posted a picture of the book on LinkedIn, and this is a pretty well-known book based on the enormous response I got. I think the book's been out for a year or so.
Just about a year.
And a lot of folks had read it, and they were very excited to see that you were going to be on the podcast. And like I say, I just loved it. I want to read an excerpt from the beginning, and then we'll get into it. From page one, if you want to understand customers, start by thinking like a detective. I've long believed the art of understanding what customers want and why they do what they do has much in common with how a detective goes about solving a mystery. Customers are endlessly surprising, often acting in ways that don't seem to make sense, and presenting, for a time at least, a mystery to be solved. A market mystery, if you will. When this happens, the best response is to look around for clues about what's going on by talking to people, observing them, gathering data, identifying patterns, and drawing out insights that suggest the right next step, just like a detective. Solid market detective skills are more needed than ever, and not just by people in specialized research departments. The maxim, "the customer is boss," has become only more urgent as the digital revolution, social media, expanding choices, and 24/7 connectivity have empowered consumers and heightened their expectations for any experience with a product, company, or brand. This means nearly everyone including those working in executive leadership, marketing, product development, sales, customer service, and even departments such as HR or finance, needs to be constantly attuned to what customers want today and in the future. What's surprising, then, is the absence of an effective approach to cracking market mysteries that anyone can learn and apply in a wide variety of situations. To be sure, powerful methods exist within the confines of market research or, increasingly, data science departments, but they are too specialized to be useful to most people working in the business world. More fundamentally, the result is often a deluge of data and analysis that, however sophisticated it may appear, falls short of the insights needed to truly improve customer lives. My goal with the secret lives of customers is to fill this gap by teaching a language, method, and mindset that equips anyone to understand the customers they serve or want to serve. At its heart is the simple but profound idea that what drives customer behavior is the existence of important, unsatisfied jobs that they are looking to get done. When these jobs arise, people look around for the best products, services, or experiences to hire to solve for them. Therefore, the top priority of any aspiring market detective should be learning how to discover, understand, and solve for these jobs. And then you go on to write, my hope is that you will find this book both useful and enjoyable, whether you work through it individually or with a team. And I hope it helps you to solve your own market mysteries, whatever they may be. So as I mentioned before, this book is exceptionally well written. And I applaud you for that. And I think it must have been a very difficult book to write. Most of the book is a detective mystery about a business, which we'll talk about in a minute here. And then the very end, like the very last section, explains the tools and methods and the mindset that the characters use. So it's like a director's cut where you explain exactly what the characters did. And it's, I best I can recall, there have only been two other books out of over 400 that use a fictional story on the Marketing Book Podcast. Now, David, I have to say this has to be one of the most enjoyable books I've read for the Marketing Book Podcast. And I love reading these books, and they're all really, for the almost without exception, really, really good. But let me give you a concrete example of how good this book is. So on last Sunday morning, I was watching some NFL pregame shows, and I muted the TV and picked up the book and started reading it. I didn't put the book down until I was 120 pages in. That has never happened before. I couldn't stop reading. I just want you to know that that is an indication of how compelling your writing was to this knucklehead. So because you have a physics degree, I do want to talk about some math. So I did the math here, okay? The first 82.7% of the book, first 83%, okay, is the mystery, right? And that's what just, I couldn't put it down because I wanted to find out what happened. And then the last 17% explains the tools and the things that we're going to talk about. And what I would propose is that we, if possible, kind of reverse the percentage and talk, you know, a little more briefly about the story, because I don't want to give it all away. After all, it is a mystery and it has a big ending. But instead, we might spend a little bit more time talking about some of the tools that the characters use that you outline very clearly at the end of your book. Does that sound okay?
Yeah, that sounds great. And thank you so much for your very kind words. That means a lot to me. I appreciate it.
So before we get started on the story, I just have to ask one personal question. Are you a Sherlock Holmes fan?
Elementary, my dear Watson.
I am. Yeah, I am. And I, more broadly, I'm a fan of mystery books in general. And as I was just brainstorming a plot premise for a book like this, I hit on this idea of trying to create a mystery. And that's the path I ended up going down.
Right. Because I noticed the main character is named Alex Baker, which brought to mind Baker Street.
Yep, that was a deliberate reference.
You yes,
make up the names of a lot of characters, and that was one source.
Well, I was thinking you buried a lot of you put a lot of little Easter eggs out there for folks, and that was the one that I caught. And then I started looking, thinking, all right, what else did he do here? But anyway, I can remember in junior high, I read a whole lot of Sherlock Holmes and enjoyed it, which may be why I enjoyed this book so much. So let's talk about the story briefly. Let's talk about the setting and the characters, and you know, kind of an overview of the plot, and perhaps we could start with why me going to a coffee shop today was significant.
Sure. Well, the whole you know premise of the book and the focus of the book is trying to teach you know anybody really not necessarily specialists but anybody who works in the business world a way that they can understand customers and teach them what they need to know to be able to do that. And I decided I wanted to do it as a kind of fictional story that was inspired by the books of Patrick Lencioni, in particular, a book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. You know, he's written books that have sold millions of copies that have a similar format, right? They're all written about 80% as a fictional story that has a compelling plot and kind of carries you along and teaches whatever concepts or frameworks he's trying to teach through the story. And then he steps out of the story at the end and talks about the ideas directly. So I grabbed onto that format. I remember reading that book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, many years ago, and just had a lot of fun reading it. And I learned a lot. And I thought, given the broad applicability or the audience of the topic of this book, that would be a fun thing to try. So the plot basically centers around this fictitious company, which is a chain of coffee shops. They're the Coffee Connection. That you were alluding to earlier, that has grown rapidly over the previous decade. They're on the cusp at the beginning of the story of doing an IPO and raising funding to go national. And just at around that time when the story starts, they start to lose a lot of customers, including some of their most loyal customers. And that's the mystery that they urgently need to solve is why is that happening? How can we reverse that and not jeopardize our IPO? And they hire a kind of unconventional market researcher who bills himself as a market detective who comes in and helps to crack market mysteries through market investigations. And the plot essentially describes how he does that over the course of the story.
And the company is called Tazza. And you could explain the significance of that name for those of us who don't speak Italian.
Yes, and I'm one of those people, but there is an Italian connection. One of the people that doesn't speak Italian. there's an Italian kind of theme throughout as well. A connection to it. So Tazza means cup in Italian, and there are a lot of naming puzzles you have to figure out when you're writing a.
Now I'm gonna have to read it again.
That was one of the choices I made for the fictitious company.
Right, and it was started by Kate Forrest.
Yes. So she has a leadership team and play various roles, and you know the main characters are you know Kate the leader of the business who's looking to turn things around. This market detective character, his name's Alex Baker, and then he has a sidekick, a kind of a Watson character that goes along with him through the plot, who is a young kind of computer data analytics, mathematics genius,
Michigan grad,
and they crack the case together. And I kind of thought that it would be fun to have two people going through the investigation together. One who represents more of the kind of advanced, modern kind of data analytic techniques around marketing and understanding customers, and one who had this more. Qualitative, more market detective orientation, and showing how the two of them together crack the case using their complementary skills and areas of expertise.
TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flipped the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called all-inclusive TV, how booming brands are reimagining TV advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a free copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. Now, tell us about Rob Butler. I didn't like him.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So I've never written a fictional story before.
Really?
And, no, but I read a lot of fiction, and I always have. It's my preferred, I'd prefer it over nonfiction. And so when I thought about doing this, I read a couple books about how to write fiction, including one in particular about how to write a mystery, like a genre mystery novel. And when you do that, one of the things you have to figure out first is, well, who's the villain, right? Who's the antagonist? And it said, you know, in the case of a conventional mystery, it always has to be a murderer. So there has to have been a murder committed, and the person has to be, you know, evil. And it didn't feel like that extreme would fly in a sort of business oriented book.
I don't know. I think there's a lot of shady marketers.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. But I didn't want to take it. But there had to be some sort of antagonist to create conflict.
Yeah,
right?
The villain.
Kind of drive the story forward. And he's not so much a villain as he is, you know, a good guy who represents a more traditional approach to marketing that I was trying to contrast with the approach, the jobs to be done approach that the market detective and his partner are illustrating and teaching through the course of the plot. So he's kind of the foil that they're contrasting with.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess I, as a reader, I read a lot into it, and I didn't like him because I think I've met people like him, and the thing I had a problem with was that he didn't know what he didn't know. In other words, from my reading, there seemed to be very little humility. And also, he had a little bit of an attitude, like he had come from a large beverage company and he was going to kind of show these rubes how it's done.
Yeah, that's right. And I, you know, I intentionally gave him some traits to make him maybe less likable than some of the other characters. And, right. But I still think he's not a bad person.
No, he's not. And we're not going to tell you what happens to him.
Yeah.
Non-spoiler alert, there are no murders in this
that's
particular.
True.
That's
yes.
The only thing I'm going to tell you folks about what happens. But it just seemed like, anyway, that got my interest. And then there's the head barista who plays a big role and the other folks. So talk about the reason I mentioned this about Rob. To use a Seinfeld joke, it's like, hello, Newman. That's kind of how I felt about Rob Butler. But the Ptolemy trap, talk about that. I love that.
Yeah, so the heart of the methodology and the approach that the book teaches is this idea of jobs to be done, customer jobs to be done. And I'm sure, given your audience, a lot of people are familiar with that idea to some extent. But
well, there's always a first-time listener, so let's not assume.
Yeah, maybe I'll just explain a little bit of that, and then
yeah, please,
and then how that relates to your question about the Ptolemy trap. So, you know, jobs to be done is at its heart a simple model for understanding why customers do what they do, or why people do what they do. Why do we, in particular, pull some products and services into our lives and adapt our lives, which always takes energy to do that. And reject others.
And let me interrupt. Yeah. Whenever I hear jobs to be done, the only person I think of is Clayton Christensen.
Yes, that's probably true of many people. There certainly are other people that have been instrumental in developing the theory over the years, and that you know, are quite expert in it around there. But Clay, you know, just given how famous he was and renowned, you know, for the disruptive innovation model, and the fact that he loved this idea of jobs to be done, and he once told me he thought it was even more important than the idea of disruptive innovation, which is his, you know, the model that he introduced to the world with his book, The Innovator's Dilemma. You know, he talked about it all the time, and if people Google Clayton Christian and milkshake, they'll find a famous video of him. telling the milkshake story, which is a beautiful story of that illustrates this idea of jobs to be done. But the basic notion is that what drives people to purchase things are not products or services in and of themselves, but rather it's the existence of important unsatisfied problems or jobs that we want to get done in our lives. And it's, you know, it's not the product that pulls me in like a magnet, but rather some job pops up in my life. And when that happens, I look around for solutions to hire. So we use jobs as a kind of a metaphor to solve for those jobs. And, a job can be a problem that you want to solve. It could be a big problem or a small problem, like I want to repair my car or soothe my sore throat, or it can be a goal you want to accomplish, like running a marathon or getting into college. And it's these jobs that drive, that motivate us to look for things to hire to perform those jobs. And so that gives you a way to understand the causality behind why people might look for something and embrace or reject a new solution. So the assumption underlying this theory of jobs to be done is that if you're a marketer, if you're a product developer, if you're a strategist, your primary focus should be understanding what jobs people are trying to get done, and then, you know, understanding them at a deep enough level that you can develop solutions that will solve them in a more compelling way than the competition. And that is in contrast. So that way of thinking about the world, you know, I call that a job-centric view of the world. That's in contrast to, say, a product-centric view of the world, where you if you're a marketer, product developer, a strategist, you frame what you're trying to do as sell more of these products that I sell. And that kind of puts it, you know, and I that's kind of a Ptolemaic way of thinking about the laws of the universe of business and customers, in the sense that, you know, Ptolemy was the astronomer who had this Earth-centric view of the solar system, and thought that, you know, everything revolves around the Earth. The Earth is at the center of the world, which was replaced by the Copernican view later. That that's not the case. We in fact are a little node in this solar system.
We're not quite as significant.
We're not as significant as we thought, and that same. I think it's a great metaphor, because I think it's very easy, and really, really smart people and very, very successful companies have a tendency to fall into this trap. And it comes up as a sort of a fun, at least I thought it was fun, metaphor in the context of the story, as the Ptolemy trap. You know, Ptolemy is spelled with a silent P, and trap is spelled with a silent P, that companies fall into, where they think about their business, their products, as being the primary orientation, as opposed to the customer, which is really what they should be focused on.
It was Jordan Sims who talked about it. Let me just quote from page 41. She said, they were talking about it, and she said, Ptolemy, ancient Greek, white beard, toga. He's the guy who believed the Earth was the center of the universe, that the sun, moon, stars, planets, everything revolved around the Earth. Pretty much everyone believed that until Copernicus came along and showed the sun was at the center and we just rotate around it. Then she says, I got a second major in astronomy for fun. So talk about the struggle between big data and small data, and then we can move on to the practical parts at the end. But that was a big part of the tension that I sensed.
Yeah. So the other, I'd say one of the other themes of the story and what the book is trying to teach is this idea that data and, you know, big data and analytics is very powerful. Certainly has an important role to play in marketing and in understanding customers. But if you start with an attempt to gather, you know, large amounts of data and analyze that data, you're very likely to fall into that trap we were just describing, because you'll be asking questions of the world that are constrained in most cases by what you already understand about the world. And the products that you sell already, you might be asking questions about how to improve them and what people like or dislike about them, and trying to gather data around that. But that will constrain your ability to really understand the causality behind why people are buying them in the first place. And that instead, you know, before you get too far down the road of big data, you should start with generating small data, which is a label for going and talking to people directly, small numbers of people, and getting really deep into what's happening in their lives. You know, what's the context? What are they experiencing? And of course, most importantly, what jobs are they trying to get done? And how are they attempting to solve those jobs to be done? Those jobs today. What's frustrating for them? What's not working? What are, you know? What else are they looking for? And that building a rich body of small data through that kind of an exercise then can inform, you know, much better big data activities.
Yes, and your book brought to mind a book that was on the show a couple years ago by Martin Lindstrom called Small Data.
Yes, that's a great book.
Yep. The Tiny Clues That Uncover Huge Trends. And I thought, whoa, what a great companion piece to read after they read yours or before. And he even writes sort of like, it's sort of like a thriller, but it's all true stories that he's telling. And it was just amazing. It's really one of my favorite ones. And let's go on to the last part of the book where we, you know, let's unpack some of these tools, you know, mindset methods. I'm going to go to page 175 and ask you to tell us what is the fundamental, most important type of customer interaction, or as you, the physics PhD, would say, the atomic unit of techniques for understanding customers. What's the one most, what's the linchpin?
Yeah, in my view, it's a one-on-one conversation between two people, and you know, it's often the single most valuable thing you can do to get to real deep and useful insights about customers. It's very efficient. You know, anybody can do it and learn how to do it. And the reason I emphasize that in the book, both in the story and in the section at the end that's the nonfiction section, was that if you can learn how to have conversations with customers that elicit those types of insights, then you can learn this language, method, and mindset that is required for any, you know, it gives you the foundation for any other kind of market research technique, whether it's a focus group or observational techniques, and even for doing, you know, quantitative surveys and more data-driven things. So I think it's the most fundamental thing to learn how to do, and I think the one that everybody working in the business world should learn.
So I think you're the second author I've interviewed who lives in Rhode Island, which for those who aren't aware of, it's the smallest American state. It's the ocean state. The other person was Kristen Zhivago, and she wrote an excellent book called Roadmap to Revenue, and a great book. And she also is she and her husband have a sailboat. So I think, isn't that required by law in Rhode Island?
It is, yes.
So
I don't have one, so I'm not,
really?
Actually adhering to the law. But,
wow.
Anyway, but nobody will find that out, I'm sure.
No. She explains exactly what to do. Wonderful book, one of my favorites. And the linchpin of the entire process that she's laid out, and she's done this for over a, you know, long, successful career, is talking one-on-one to customers. So there's something going on in Rhode Island where there's a lot of good advice.
It's a small state, you know, so we're all kind of crammed together. So maybe we're always talking to each other.
Yeah, but it was...
Yeah, I'll check that out. I haven't heard of that one, but that's one of the reasons I love your podcast is that I find out about so many cool books.
Oh, thanks. Well, I'll have to open up a Starbucks tab somewhere, and you guys can just meet there.
That sounds good. I'll hold you to that.
Yeah. So I want to quote from page 178. Talk about, you know, the fundamentals of understanding customers. Okay, this isn't brain surgery. It's not rocket science. Why? It's not even rocket surgery. But That I'm saying that. That's not in David's very well-written book. But I want to quote from page 178 where you write, "Unlike in the case of doctors, lawyers, or accountants, there's no standard widely accessible language to guide interactions with customers. Instead, what exists tends to be either the purview of highly trained specialists or, at the opposite extreme, too vague and ambiguous to be useful. Even more problematic, many existing approaches guide investigators to ask the wrong questions, generating vast quantities of data and analysis about things that may not even really matter." And I've seen that a lot, David. So yeah. Talk about what's needed, you know, what is needed to help people ask the right questions, to get the right kind of insights and the right level of detail.
Yeah. So I thought a lot in writing this book, and you know, even the process of writing it helped me work out my own thinking about the answer to that question, which is what does somebody really need to learn to be able to elicit insights to have useful customer conversations? And the way I describe it in the book is that you need to learn three things. You need a language, a method, and a mindset. And by language, I mean, there are a lot of things you could learn about. Let's say your customer is a person, but all of this also applies if it's a B2B context, if your customer is an organization, but just focus on maybe individuals for the moment. There are a lot of things you could learn about a person. Like, there's a lot of things I could learn about you, Douglas, if I was, say, in the coffee business and I wanted you to come into my coffee shop more and buy more coffee.
Okay, David, those charges were dropped. I know where you're going with this.
We're looking forward, Douglas. We're not looking back anymore.
Thank you. Thank you. On this celebratory day, I appreciate that sentiment.
That's all in the past as far as I'm concerned. But there's a lot of things I could learn about you, and they're probably all interesting, but only some of the things are going to help me create better solutions for you, you know, in the realm of coffee and you know, leisure activities and so on. And so what you need is a kind of specialized vocabulary so that you have words that will give you a way to describe what it is you're trying to understand about customers in the first place, right? And so I think the first thing everybody needs is a language for for understanding customers. One element of the language that I'm describing in this book is this idea of a job to be done, right? That's sort of a special vocabulary term that we're using in a distinct way. And that's one of the things you're trying to understand about customers. And there's a bunch of other elements to the language as well. But the first thing you need is a language. And then secondly, you need a method, right? And here I really had to make some choices about what to include and what not to include and how to think about this. So this isn't a book about a particular market research technique, but rather it's what are the, by method I mean, what are the questions that you're trying to answer about customers? And those are independent of how you answer them, right? So there's a difference between the questions you're trying to answer and then the way you go about answering them. Mm-hmm. And there are things like what jobs are people trying to get done? What are their circumstances they're in? Their context? What are they hiring today? How do they define what quality means to them? What are the help wanted signs, right? So what are the indicators that there are opportunities to better solve their jobs? And so that sort of is how I frame the method. And then the mindset is just a set of attitudes you want to go into this type of exercise with to maximize your chances of success.
But one thing you never ask a customer is, what job is it you're trying to get done, right?
Well, that's right, because they wouldn't know what you were talking about, right? And so that's why there's this moment when Jordan, so one of the reasons I introduced this character of Jordan is so that she and the main character could teach each other things, and therefore they could fill in for the reader, right? They're sort of representing the reader who's learning as they teach each other things.
And I was learning along with Jordan as Alex was sort of demonstrating.
Yeah, but what I also had her do is kind of pithily summarize some of the learnings as she went through, as a way to kind of reinforce it for the reader of the book. And the way she summarized this is that the questions you ask are not the questions you seek to answer. And he makes a joke that sounds kind of like Yoda, but she meant by that exactly your point, which is the questions you're trying to answer are things like what jobs are people trying to get done. Those are not the questions, obviously, you're going to ask people. You need to ask other things to elicit that type of insight. But you know, and I'm sure you've done customer interviews in your career, as have I'm sure many of your listeners. The best ones are often ones that ramble around a little bit and they kind of lead in unexpected directions. And so what I was trying to, one of the reasons I used a fictional format is I wanted to kind of capture that feel of how those interviews feel. But at the same time, if you keep these questions in your head of that you're trying to answer, this method, it gives you a sort of architecture and structure in your mind that brings order to those rambling conversations and guides you to make sure that you're actually getting something useful.
Yes, and you can even start to put it on one page, which you show very specifically. Let's talk just a little bit more about the circumstances that someone is in, because that's pivotal. It relates to the map that you have that we'll talk about in a minute. Yeah. What that helps me with is, you know, there's a needle, there's a haystack. This helps to get a lot of the hay away. Talk about the circumstances. You touched on some of it, but like the situational, I think you've got situational, demographic, identity, and agency. Can you give us examples of circumstances? Like with the chemistry student, the pre-med student that came into the cafe.
Sure. So this idea of a circumstance, that's another vocabulary word in this specialized language. And I would view it as being just as important as the idea of jobs to be done, because you know, opportunities to create a solution for a customer occur at the – they're not defined just by a job by itself, but rather the intersection of a job in a circumstance. And so what do I mean by circumstance? Well, a circumstance is the relevant context within which someone is trying to get a particular job done. And we can talk about what relevant means, but we don't try to get jobs done in a vacuum or in some general abstract sense, but they arise in a particular context. And in the case that you're describing, so there's a character. So back to the story and the plot. The market investigators visit the various coffee shops and have conversations, one-on-one conversations with people who are, hiring the coffee shop, right, to get certain jobs done, to try to understand what those jobs are. And it's a diverse set of people that they talk to. And one of them is a woman who they learn, a young student who is a pre-med going to a college that's near the coffee shop, and comes in, three times a week after school to work on her homework from her chemistry class. And if you're trying to understand her jobs to be done, you also want to understand her circumstances. So what are some of the contextual factors that define where she is right then? So they're situational things, like she's coming from a class that's not far away. She is, by herself. She's, got a laptop. She wants to work on her laptop and get work done. So there's some factors like that. There are demographic variables that define her circumstance. So she's, in college. She's turns out far from home. She lives her family's in another state. She's in her last year of school before she wants to go to medical school, right? So these are kind of demographic factors.
She likes the smell of coffee.
She loves the smell of coffee.
But she didn't drink it.
But she didn't drink it, right? Yeah. Which is interesting. And so,
because it reminded her of her parents.
Yeah, exactly. And so they get into that, right? So they start to get into, okay, well, what jobs are you hiring this cup of coffee to get done? And they discover a bunch of really interesting things, and they very much are related to and informed by the circumstances that she's in. So one job is to just get her work done, right? So she comes there in the, you know, after school to get work done, and it's a great location because she doesn't, there are people around, and so, you know, if she goes to the library, if she goes to an empty classroom, it feels kind of lonely, but here there's sort of people around, so she feels like she's not alone. And she purchases a cup of coffee both because she feels like it's you have to pay the rent. That's kind of like the rent you pay to feel good about occupying a table for a couple hours,
right?
Even though she doesn't really drink or like coffee. And then it also reminds her of home, right? And she's far away from home and a little homesick. So you can kind of see how the jobs she has are very much interrelated with these circumstance variables.
The other thing, like I said, the circumstances is so appealing to me because it helps companies to realize what they should stop wasting their time on. And effort. Like an example would be, they had music on Saturday nights, and one of her teaching assistants was in a band, and she came to watch it, and she went to support this teaching assistant, and also because she wanted to get a good grade. But she said she would never come back for that. And yet the company was probably thinking, oh, we should do more of this. And they're like, no, that's not what people are coming here for. So it's just, it was very interesting. Let's, the jobs to be done. Let me just reprise that one more time. We say, which can be either be a problem someone is trying to solve, our goal someone is trying to achieve. Just, can you briefly explain the idea of functional jobs, emotional jobs, and social jobs? I can understand that people might grasp functional jobs more quickly, but not so much emotional jobs and social jobs.
Yeah, and I think about these three categories of jobs as being just another layer down of the language, right? Remember, the language is aimed at giving, you know, people a vocabulary they can use to know what it is they're trying to get at with respect to understanding customers. And it's a useful categorization scheme because mostly people are naturally going to focus on functional jobs, which are the kind of practical things that you are trying to achieve. But very often, we're simultaneously wanting to solve what we're calling emotional and social jobs. So an emotional job is like an emotional state that you a feeling that you either want to feel, or maybe it's just one that you want to avoid. And a social job, we define it as the way that you want to either be perceived by or interact with others. Mm-hmm. So if you think about a good example is like a car. You know, if you ask yourself, well, why did I hire, you know, the last car I purchased? There's going to be some functional jobs for that always. And I want to get from point A to point B. Maybe I want to commute to work. Maybe I have kids and I need to take them to school. I got to carry stuff around, right? So there's a bunch of functional jobs. Mm-hmm. But then there are emotional jobs. So maybe I want to feel like I'm a responsible parent. And so I buy like a very safe car. Or maybe I want to feel successful. So I buy a fancy a BMW or something, because I want to feel like I've made it. I want to feel proud or successful. Maybe I very much value the environment, and I want to feel like I'm doing a good job for the planet, and so I buy a hybrid or a more fuel-efficient car. Those are the kinds of emotional jobs that might drive you to purchase one car versus another. Social jobs could be, you know, the way I want other people to think that I'm environmentally conscious or successful, and so I want to project that with my choice of car. And usually when we buy anything, we're not trying to solve just one narrow job, but it's a bundle of things that we're optimizing across.
Yeah.
And so, when you buy a car, you're trying to get it all of those things. Companies have a tendency to focus mostly on the functional, but these other types of jobs can be big drivers of behavior, of course.
One of my favorite books is called Buyer Personas by Adele Ravella. And I'm sure you've heard of the concept of buyer personas. And in that book, there are about five insights that she advises that you try to find. And it's really, really helpful. It's worked really well for us. And, you know, we've used it to do some research. And I should also add that in the story, Alex and Jordan, was that her name?
Yep.
They were thrown out of the competitor's location a couple of times. Yes. And I thought, yeah, I've been thrown out of places trying to do competitive. So, but you're not doing it right if you're not getting thrown out of some place. So in her, Adele's approach, one of the five insights is about what really matters to your customers. And it's almost always not what the company thinks. And you come back and we share with them how what really matters to them. They go, no. And normally it's like, oh, we think they're buying the product. No, they're not. There's other things very important. And page 184, you write, the world is full of innovations offering features and benefits their creators were excited about, but that customers ignored or rejected. The way to avoid this is to understand what really matters from your customer's perspective. Can you talk about some of the ways that help companies better understand what actually matters to their customers instead of what they think matters to them or what matters to the Ptolemy people at the company?
Yeah, well, so one of the other elements of the language is this idea of understanding what quality means from the customer's perspective. So how, for a particular job in a particular circumstance, how would they define what a high quality solution would look like? And that's a really important thing to understand about a customer, so that you can, you know, engineer your solutions to match that definition of quality. What variable, like what kind of selection criteria do they use? I mean, cost is always a dimension, but is it about ease of use? Is it about, every product category or type of job is going to have some set of evaluative criteria that people are going to use. And
like trade-offs.
What trade-offs are they willing to make? And you know, what's more important and less important? And so to get it, I mean, there are various techniques to get at that, but it's often very useful to understand, you know, what if anything are they hiring today to get those jobs done, and why? What do they like or not like? Like, why are they choosing one thing versus another? And that can give you a lot of really useful information about the implicit or explicit way that they define what quality is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it could be, you know, essential features that have to be there. Like in the case of the young woman in the coffee shop who goes there to work, she's frustrated by the lack of power outlets, right? which is a detail I can certainly relate. I mean, that sort of comes from my own experience because I'm always working in coffee shops. But you know, it doesn't have anything to do with coffee. It has to do with your ability to sit for a few hours and work on your laptop when you're low on power. And you wouldn't know that unless you went and kind of observed that person and had a conversation with them about, you know, exactly why they like the solution or don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Quick definition. What is a help wanted sign? I think we just started to touch on one there.
Yeah. So I was worried about this one in that it maybe is taking the Jobs metaphor just a little bit too far, but the idea is that, these are indicators that, for a particular job in a particular circumstance, you know, relative to whatever solutions are available, there's opportunities to create something better, right? So there's different types of help wanted signs. So it could be that there's literally no solution for a particular job, and therefore, you know, the existence of an important and unsatisfied job is itself the help wanted sign. It could be that there are barriers to getting a job done. There might be solutions, but for some reason there are barriers to particular people consuming them, whether it's too complex or it's hard to access or it's too expensive. And or it could be that there are solutions available, there's no barriers, but They don't make the right trade-offs, to your point. So these are all different types of indicators that things could be improved or that there's room for a better solution. And this element of the language, this idea of a help-wanted sign and the taxonomy around that gives you a way to describe those different things that you're trying to understand that are help-wanted signs.
So the market investigation method, this is the last thing I want to ask you about, is the four questions, which we've touched on largely, there's four of them. What circumstance is the customer in? Be specific. What jobs is the customer trying to get done? So there's a, you know, the variety of layers there that need to be considered. The three is, what is the customer hiring today to get those jobs done and why? And four is, what are the help wanted signs? So I just wanted to talk about the job specs and yeah. The market map, because again, we can only talk conceptually here because this is an audio sure. only podcast, but this is the thing that you can actually put up on the wall. You could put it up on a whiteboard and talk about the two axes of the X and the Y, the latitude, longitude of jobs and circumstances. It all comes down to jobs and circumstances.
Yeah. So a market map is one of the kind of major frameworks that threads throughout the book and the story and the nonfiction part. And I had to be pretty choiceful about what to include and what not to include. And I chose that one because it's a really useful way to apply jobs to be done at a more strategic level. It gives you a way to map out, pockets of opportunity that are defined by, the intersections of jobs and circumstances. So you could create a market, and there is one that's created through this market investigation for all of the different people that hire this coffee shop. And it gives you a way to visually depict that, and that if you get them right, it's a way you can map out, well, where am I actually playing today? What markets am I in? Who am I competing with in different parts of this market? Where are there white spaces that I might go tomorrow? Because those are the primary axes of the map, it does it in a way that inherently puts the customer at the center of the whole conversation.
It's like you trick people into putting the customer at the center, but it reveals clusters of where you have no business trying to compete, like the musicians on Saturday night. And I'm looking at an example of one here at the end, and it's on the left side, there's a series of rows, and it says, we're back to Amelia, the pre-med student. Get schoolwork done, feel connected with family, connect with friends, be entertained, meet new people. And then across the top are all the different circumstances. And it's not an infinite number of circumstances, but like for hers, it was, late afternoon or Saturday night. And Saturday night, it was all X's. That is definitely not what she wanted. But also in the story, as I recall, at the final retreat, just before the big murder scene, I'm kidding. I can't. Again, there's no murders. But there was only one slide that Alex put up on the board, and it was this map, right?
Yeah, because it just has great explanatory power for. And again, they take some work to get right, and the one in the story obviously was engineered to be a good teaching example, but it really does give you a way to visualize. Okay, here's all of the places that we're playing today. Either intentionally or unintentionally, right? Because this is literally where people are hiring us, our service or our product, or in this case, the coffee shop, to get jobs done today. Here's all the other people that are they're also hiring sometimes that we're actually competing with for those jobs. Now let's make a decision about, well, do we want to play in all those places? Do we want to play in fewer places? Do we want to double down in some places? A product-centric view would just say, well, it doesn't matter where we are on that map as long as we sell lots of products. So we just want to sell products everywhere we possibly can. Whereas a job-centric view would force you to be more intentional about, well, we could sell products in all those places, but we've only got finite resources where we want to focus, and we really think we have an advantage and we should play in this place versus that.
Yes. Now, I know I said that was the last question, but there's one other one I want to ask. I'm sorry. And that's because I have a feeling there are probably some B2B people sitting there, and they're, you know, they got their arms crossed, and they're thinking, yeah, that's real nice, podcast boy, but I'm a B2B company. This doesn't apply. I'm not a damn coffee chain. And I want to quote from page 187, where you say, before moving on, it's worth commenting on how this applies when the customer you're trying to understand is not a person, but an organization or B2B customer. These are by definition made up of many people, so you might assume that one-on-one conversations are not as relevant. What say you, David Scott Duncan?
Well, I would say that.
you did, in fact.
Yes.
There's a few distinguishing complexities here that you make clear in the book. Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a couple of complexities, right, which is that when you're selling into a business, you typically are selling to a group of people or to a kind of decision-making system. It may not just be to one particular I mean, it might be to one contact in the business, but you might have to be understanding the jobs of more than one person because there's some, say, selection committee for your product, and it's not just one person. And then the other complexity is that there's two different types of jobs that any person in a B2B customer will have that you have to take into account. There's what I would call role-based jobs. So these are jobs that person has on behalf of the organization because of their role in it. So what do I mean by that? Well, if you're, let's say you're selling to a CFO, what are some of the jobs that a CFO has for the organization because they're a CFO? Well, they have to do things like, you know, make sure the company doesn't run out of cash and make sure we're not taking, you know, we're managing risk appropriately, or, you know, create, you know, financial forecasts for the market or for internally. Like those are role-based jobs that the CFO has that maybe the, you know, the CEO or some other person working in the organization does not have. And so you have to understand those if the CFO is your B2B customer contact. But then that person will also have individual jobs that relate to their career. So, you know, take a CEO. A CEO might have role-based jobs like, you know, build a strong leadership team or, you know, communicate my vision to the market. Those are role-based jobs. But that CEO also might have personal jobs like, you know, build a legacy for myself or, you know, set myself up for my next CEO role that's going to be even bigger and better, or whatever they might be,
or affirm the decision the board had to hire him.
Yeah,
or
absolutely, right? You know, manage my work-life balance. Although most CEOs I met are not as worried about that. But that's a work-related job that we all have, right? And so you. The B2B application still works, but it's more complex because there's more stakeholders, and then there's more types of jobs you have to worry about.
Right, but it doesn't mean it just doesn't work. I mean, as I was reading through it, I was just thinking of B2B things throughout. So it works well for B2B, and you have a section in here that explains the other complexities that make it successful. And also, one other thing I want to mention that. I know I was busted on Rob Butler, the marketing guy, but he also played a very important role in the story in that he was asking the questions that I think a lot of companies would ask. He was the doubting Thomas that was really quite helpful for Alex to make his point. So I see what you did there. So, David, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I'd say if there's a customer that you're trying to help, or even just a person you're trying to help, right? Because I think everybody has customers in their role, you know, people that they're trying to help, you know, solve problems and achieve goals. So if there's a customer you're trying to help, your number one priority should be understanding the jobs that customer is trying to get done in their lives and how their circumstances influence that. And that the best way to go do that is to go talk to them.
So when I ask you what is one thing a listener could do today to put in action an idea from your book, would it possibly be go talk to your customers?
Yeah, absolutely, right. Go have a conversation with a customer, a potential customer, a stakeholder you're trying to help. You know, keep it open-ended. and get at their problems and goals
stop talking about your product.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly.
That's right. Well, looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
I was inspired by a couple books by Clay Christensen. I read The Innovator's Dilemma a long time ago when I first was getting involved at Innosight, which is the company he co-founded and where I've worked for the last 16 years. He also wrote a wonderful book called How Will You Measure Your Life that applies a lot of these same frameworks, including jobs to be done, to thinking about what it means to live a good life and how to design a good life, which I really loved. I found this book, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, influential in the sense that I loved just the storytelling aspect of that.
Uh-huh.
There's a handful of other, business books that I turn to again and again just on special topics.
Oh, interesting. Yes, The Five Dysfunctions has been mentioned by a number of authors on the show. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or have heard of that you're looking forward to reading or have them come out?
So I have one called Talent, which is by Tyler Cowen. He's this, he must be a genius. He's like this polymath economics professor who runs this blog called Marginal Revolution that he posts links and articles on every day that he's just this prolific thinker. And he writes, comes out with a new book, it seems like, every year. Mm. And this is his, I haven't read it yet, but it's supposed to be a really innovative, creative look at how you think about finding great talent and nurturing talent.
Very timely. Yeah. I see it's Talent, How to Identify Energizers, Creatives, and Winners Around the World.
Yeah.
Very
so
timely.
That's one. And then on the fiction front, I don't know if you've ever read, there's this guy, George Saunders, who's an American author who writes these just brilliant short stories. He's about to come out with his next collection in October, which I'm looking forward to.
Oh, good. Well, let me ask you one other question, if not this book, that is, somebody wanted to learn more about the jobs to be done. Is there one book that you would recommend that they start with? And I should also add, I'm going to try and find that milkshake video to include on your episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com.
Yeah. So the other book I think is a nice overview of the idea of jobs is a book called Competing Against Luck, which Clay and a couple of other folks and myself wrote back in 2016.
Okay.
And it's more about the concept at a more general level. It's less about how to apply it. But it has a bunch of, it's a Clay Christensen book, and Clay was such a wonderful storyteller that I think there's a lot of great stories in it. And it's a relatively easy read, I think. So,
well, and it was a Wall Street Journal bestseller.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think anything Clay would write would meet that bar.
Yeah. Well, I was sorry to see he passed away, and he was a great person as well.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah, he was a great human being.
So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, your site, which is marketdetective.com, and your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account, and that video, if I can find it. And now, word to you, dear listener, I want to ask you a big favor. Please reach out in some way to David and congratulate him on this book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Hey, he's a fellow listener, just like you. Send him a message on LinkedIn, Twitter, or go to his website. But thank him for being a guest, because let's hope this isn't his last book, and maybe he'll come back to see us. Guests on the show have told me how much they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on the website link. Final quote, page 208. Becoming proficient in the art of the market detective may seem like a daunting task, particularly if you're just getting started. There's a whole new language to remember, a new method and toolkit to master, and mindsets to adopt that come more naturally for some than others, and all while navigating the unpredictability of real live encounters with customers. Rest assured that anyone who invests the time and effort can be successful, and it is well worth it. I can attest to this from my own experience as I progressed from rarely encountering customers in the wild to spending thousands of hours engaged in fascinating, inspiring, and often humbling conversations with them. This work has taken me around the world and allowed me to meet and learn from an extraordinarily diverse group of people. And then finally, you write, you describe several of them. In all of these cases, and in many others, my goal was to understand the lives of customers deeply enough that others could use this knowledge to find ways to make their lives better. It is enormously gratifying when this is the result. If I can learn to do this, you can too. Success ultimately comes not from memorizing specific techniques, but from practicing a small set of principles, the principles I've described in this book. I wish you luck in mastering them and in using them to crack whatever market mysteries you encounter in your career and life. The book is The Secret Lives of Customers, a detective story about solving the mystery of customer behavior. The author is David Scott Duncan. David, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Douglas. I really enjoyed it, and happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a free copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book. And tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you're one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."